Programs regularly scheduled for this time will not be seen today in order that we might bring you the following NBC News special report. Watergate, Senate hearings. To ensure complete live nationwide coverage of the Senate Watergate hearings, the three commercial television networks are rotating the daily coverage. NBC has responsibility for today's live coverage. Now from Washington, here is NBC News correspondent Douglas Kiker.
Good afternoon. The afternoon session of the Watergate hearings are about to begin. The senators are beginning to wander back into the committee room. John Ehrlichman is still the witness. Mr. Ehrlichman spent all morning testifying about what went on at the White House after the March 21st meeting between John Dean and President Nixon, the meeting when John Dean told the president all that he knew about Watergate and told the president that Watergate was a cancer upon the presidency. Essentially, John Ehrlichman has corroborated the president's public statements as to when and how he learned the truth about the Watergate affair. Mr. Ehrlichman has been a tough, articulate, poised witness, one not easily intimidated, a witness who gives as good as he gets. He has contradicted testimony of John Mitchell, Maurice Stans, Herbert Kalmbach, and especially the testimony of John Dean. If he paints anyone as a villain in this whole thing, it is John Dean. Ehrlichman started testifying Tuesday morning, and he may not finish today. We may see him again on Monday. In any event, when he concludes, H.R. Haldeman will be the next witness. But Ehrlichman's testimony, most people think, is the most important. He is the key witness, and committee members have only begun asking him questions about his involvement in the Watergate cover-up. That's what we'll be hearing this afternoon. So we'll be back with more on the Watergate affair in just a moment.
Coffee and Grimora. Grimora! Where'd she put it? She changed me from cream to Grimora. Now she hides it.
Grimora, the non-dairy creamer. It tastes so much like cream and coffee, you'd expect to find it in the refrigerator.
Helen, there's no Grimora in the refrigerator!
It's not inside, it's on top!
It's not inside, it's on top.
Only 11 calories, a level teaspoon.
Well, I'm looking at our monitor of the caucus room, and I see that Senator Montoya is the only senator there. So far as I know, no votes are scheduled on the Senate floor, at least not at the moment. So outside the Senate caucus room, we have our intrepid reporters, Carl Stern and Paul Duke. I wonder if they can tell us what's the holdup, or is there a holdup? Paul?
Well, Douglas, there was a vote right after the committee recessed for lunch, another vote on the campaign spending reforms bill, which is now the major item of business on the Senate floor. I think this delayed the senators in going to lunch. And as you suggest, only Senator Montoya has arrived at the committee. It's not unusual, as you well know, for the sessions of this committee to get underway 10 and 15 minutes late, and that apparently is going to occur again. You may recall, Doug, as we were winding up the morning session, we talked to Senator Gurney, the Florida Republican, who told us that he felt that the committee should proceed to go through the entire month of August, if necessary, to wind up this first phase of the hearings, the phase which is dealing with the major witnesses. Since then, I've talked to Senator Talmadge, who told me that he endorses the same concept, that he favors the committee going straight through to get through Ehrlichman, Haldeman, Charles Colson, and Patrick Gray, the former FBI, the former acting FBI director. These witnesses would comprise the majority of the major witnesses and would enable the committee to conclude the first phase of the hearings. Now, I think we know that there are other senators on the committee who favor this course as well. Senator Inouye has indicated that he, too, believes the proceedings should continue, that they should not stop for the August recess. Senator Ervin has said that he would like to wind up by August 3rd, but there now appears to be a good likelihood that the chairman, Senator Ervin, could be outvoted by his committee and the proceedings could continue. As you can see on your monitor, John Ehrlichman has just arrived for the afternoon session. He has just taken his seat in the witness chair. It is unlikely now that Mr. Ehrlichman's testimony will be completed today. some of the committee lawyers are saying they believe there are sufficient questions to keep the interrogation of Mr. Ehrlichman going into next week, possibly through Tuesday. We know that the committee's chief counsel, Sam Dash, has a host of additional questions which he intends to put to Mr. Ehrlichman. So all in all, it looks like Ehrlichman will be on the stand into next week, and there is a growing likelihood that the committee will not wind up the first phase of the hearings on August 3rd as the committee had hoped to do.
Thank you, Paul. I think it might be well, before the afternoon session begins, to shortly wrap up where Mr. Ehrlichman was and what he was saying when the morning session ended. Mr. Ehrlichman said that on March the 30th, the president called him on the telephone and said that he was satisfied that John Dean was deep into the Watergate affair and thereby transferred to Mr. Ehrlichman the responsibility for everything as far as Watergate was concerned. Mr. Ehrlichman said he then proceeded to have a series of meetings with Mr. Dean, with Paul O'Brien, who is an attorney for the committee to re-elect the president. And at the end of these meetings, on April the 14th, he made a complete report to the president. He said that it was a narrative report. The two of them sat down together, and it was a report based on the interviews with Mr. O'Brien and Mr. Dean. He said at that time he did not know the full story of the payoff of hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Watergate defendants, but he said he told the president about the meetings at which the political espionage plan was formed. He told the president about the two break-ins of the Democratic National Committee. He told the president what he knew about the cover-up. He said the president's reaction was to tell him that he should immediately advise Attorney General Richard Kleindienst, and that he, John Ehrlichman, did this within the hour. That was on a Saturday, the 14th of April, and the following day, Sunday, was a day of frenzied activity, both for Mr. Ehrlichman and for President Nixon. He met the president again twice, meetings that went on into the night. He said the president went over and over the information that he had. And then the next day, on April the 17th, was the day when President Nixon issued his next statement, in which he said he had learned of new developments in the Watergate affair. Now, that's where we are at this point in Mr. Ehrlichman's testimony. Senator Gurney was the last committee member to question Mr. Ehrlichman this morning, but you may be sure that from now on, most of the questioning, at least I anticipate, that most of the questioning will be about this cover-up activity. What did Mr. Ehrlichman know, and when did Mr. Ehrlichman know it, as well as the president? I see that Carl Stern is down outside the committee caucus room. Carl, have you got any news for us?
Not really. During the lunch hour, Doug, I went to the law library of a favorite senator and started digging through some books. I was curious, when was the last time that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the question of whether a member of another branch of government had to obey a subpoena? And interestingly enough, there is such a case just a year ago. On the 29th of June of last year, the Supreme Court ruled that an aide to Senator Gravel, a Dr. Rodberg, had to testify before a grand jury which was inquiring into how Senator Gravel managed to obtain a copy of the Pentagon Papers. Now, interestingly, in that decision, the Supreme Court viewed Dr. Rodberg and Senator Gravel as one person, and they held in their ruling that a United States senator has the same obligation as any other citizen to go before a grand jury and testify, to respond to a subpoena, to testify at a trial, as anyone else, so long as what he was testifying about concerned the conduct of a third party, and so long as it did not involve asking him about a legislative act. Well, there's a very close parallel then between that decision, and it was a decision, and the case here involving President Nixon. The grand jury, in the case of Special Prosecutor Cox, wants to ask the president about deeds of third parties, that is to say Mr. Dean, Mr. Mitchell, Mr. Haldeman, Mr. Ehrlichman, and others, and does not want to inquire about a constitutional act of the president. In other words, that's the functional equivalent of their use of the word legislative act in the Gravel decision. So that is the last word that we have ever had from the Supreme Court on the subject. It is not a decision which I would think would help President Nixon's case. Curiously enough, the decision was written by Justice White, but he got the additional four votes that he needed from Mr. Nixon's own appointees. And that suggests that there might be a final irony in all of this, which is that Mr. Nixon's own appointees would defeat him in the Supreme Court if the matter got there, and perhaps the only support Mr. Nixon could obtain would be from liberals like Justice Douglas, Brennan, Marshall, people who the president has expressed some dislike for.
The last we heard, Carl, Sam Dash was going to take his time to write up this paper to be presented to the court, because it is unprecedented, as we know, that he was going to research it thoroughly, that all members of the committee staff were going to take part in it, and consequently that the court would not receive it until sometime next week. I wonder, do you have any sort of progress report at all about what's happening? Has Mr. Dash at this point really sat down and gone to work on this, or what?
That's an easy question to answer, because we have absolutely no progress report. As far as we know, there has been no progress.
I'd like to go back and talk for a minute and ask you and Paul to comment, if you will, about Mr. Ehrlichman's testimony. I think that so many people have testified, there's so many facts, so many characters involved, that we tend to lose track, that we have to listen very hard to understand what people are saying. What we are hearing, in effect, is Mr. Ehrlichman contradict John Dean on several important points, and we have a real clash of wills here. You remember that shortly after these events occurred, which Mr. Ehrlichman is testifying to now, Mr. Dean put out a public statement without anybody's knowledge, anybody within the White House, saying that he was not going to be a scapegoat. And it was from that moment on that he took his position that, in effect, that Mr. Haldeman and Mr. Ehrlichman were both involved in the cover-up from the beginning and were trying to make him take all the blame for it. There was a flurry of reports reported to be from Mr. Dean, in which this was expanded upon, and then finally Mr. Dean testified at great length to this effect. Now we have John Ehrlichman testifying just the opposite, that in fact John Dean was the villain. John Dean was the man who kept facts about the Watergate conspiracy and the Watergate cover-up hidden not only from President Nixon, but hidden from him, John Ehrlichman. This is a basic contradiction, and it's a very important contradiction, because somebody's lying, and somebody's lying a lot. So I think that what we are going to see now is other members of this committee question John Ehrlichman very closely about what he said this morning. Carl Stern or Paul Duke, I wonder if you have any comments about that. Isn't this really down to the crunch now, I suppose, is what I'm asking?
Well, I think it is, Doug, and you're quite correct. The contradictions and the conflicts continue to grow, and each day it seems to me that John Ehrlichman has made a point of emphasizing that John Dean was not telling the truth when he testified, that John Dean was the major culprit. As you suggested, he was the real villain in the episode. And today, we had testimony by Mr. Ehrlichman suggesting that Dean, in his celebrated meeting with the president on March 21st, did not, as he had said, tell the president everything he knew about Watergate. In other words, he had lied to the president in giving his version of the events about Watergate. And so the dispute over who's telling the truth, over who is lying, just continues to grow. There are so many contradictions, and I think we lose, as the hearings progress day by day, I think it's very difficult, because we're so overwhelmed with minutiae and little facts about the case, it's very difficult to put everything in focus. I know that some of the committee lawyers, Carl, you've talked to them as I have, take the view that it would be good to recess the hearings for a couple of weeks so they could review all the testimony, so they could try to pin down the conflict so they would become more apparent.
I think in the long run, we'll probably have to get the resolution of some of these conflicts from third parties who were present during the conversations or who had a role. Let me give you an example of that. I don't recall that it's been pursued in this session with Mr. Ehrlichman, but if my memory serves me, long ago Mr. Dean testified that when Mr. Walters of the CIA questioned a request that Mr. Dean made, which concerned the alleged effort to get the CIA to cover up some of the Watergate activities, that General Walters questioned his authority, and that Mr. Dean said, well, call Mr. Ehrlichman, clear it for yourself. And it's our understanding from what Mr. Dean said that General Walters did call Mr. Ehrlichman.
Now, if he did, then I presume when General Walters appears here at some future point as a witness that he'll be asked about that, and he can explain whether, in fact, he was at that early stage of the cover-up instructed by Mr. Dean to call Mr. Ehrlichman. If so, that would suggest that Mr. Ehrlichman did have an early role in the matter. On the other hand, if Mr. Walters says, no, it never happened, Mr. Dean is lying, well, then we'll know a little bit about Mr. Dean's testimony. There are a number of these peripheral witnesses who then become quite important, and that's why Mr. Dash now has a long list of people he considers crucial. Let's take a look at that list. I hope I remember them all. After Mr. Haldeman, he wants to go to Mr. Colson. Then after Mr. Colson, he wants Mr. Kleindienst, the former Attorney General, Henry Peterson, the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division, L. Patrick Gray, the former Acting Director of the FBI, General Walters, Vernon Walters, Richard Helms, both those men of the CIA. He wants David Young, who was a member of the Plumbers Unit and wrote a number of the memos that have been introduced in evidence here to Mr. Ehrlichman, General Cushman of the CIA, Eagle Krogh, who was affiliated with the Plumbers Unit. I guess I've named about 10 people, and that's why these hearings are not over yet and have a long way to go.
And let's not forget that some of the witnesses who have already testified almost certainly will be called back for additional testimony to try to clarify some of the conflicts and discrepancies which have developed.
And perhaps it should be said as well, in the long run, this is not a Perry Mason melodrama. It may well be that at no point can someone stand up and say, aha, there's the answer. X was right and Y was wrong. A was lying and B was telling the truth. And in the grown world, the fact remains that a case goes to the jury, and I suppose the American public and the senators are a jury, with two conflicting versions of the facts. And the jury is asked to exercise its best judgment and apply a little bit of common sense and real-life experience to say who convinced them. Whose version do they believe? And in the long run, that may be what happens here.
Well, it occurs to me that so far what John Ehrlichman has done is exactly what he was supposed to do, which was tell the story, the official White House version of the story, and to stick to it, despite whatever onslaughts he might receive from Senator Ervin and others. Incidentally, we are told that Senator Ervin is on the way, so these hearings should be commencing in any moment now. Mr. Ehrlichman has done just that. He's been a strong witness for the White House story that President Nixon was not involved in either the cover-up nor the commission of the Watergate break-in. So what we got down to, I think, what we would have gotten down to was who was telling the truth, John Dean or John Ehrlichman. And it occurs to me that that might have been the end of it, except for an accident. We've had two real accidents in this whole affair so far. One was when James McCord broke and decided to talk. That's what brought everything out in the open. And then the other big accident, I think, happened last week when, out of the blue, Alexander Butterfield, a former assistant to H.R. Haldeman, testified that the president's EOB office and that his Oval Office was bugged, so that suddenly we knew that tape recordings existed of all of these conversations, tape recordings which could tell us who is lying and who's not lying. That added an extra dimension to the thing. It has immediately resulted in what appears to be a forthcoming classic historic confrontation between the legislative and executive branches of the government. But it also means that tape recordings exist which can prove who's telling the truth and who isn't, except for the fact that the existence of these recordings is now known to be true, admitted by the White House. It would be John Dean versus John Ehrlichman, and John Ehrlichman has been a very persuasive, forceful witness. So that's what we're up against. Mr. Ehrlichman has not really been challenged specifically and at great length in detailed, hard-hitting cross-examination by any member of this committee. He's just now begun to talk about what went on with the cover-up. I see, to interrupt myself, outside the caucus room again, that Carl Stern has the chief committee counsel, Sam Dash. Carl? Excuse me, it's not Sam Dash, it's Dave Dawson of the committee. Carl?
Well, that's right, Doug. Mr. Dawson is an assistant counsel. You asked earlier about the progress being made in the lawsuit that the Senate is contemplating filing next week. There are a number of members of the staff who have been working on that suit, and one would be Mr. Dawson.
Well, I'm not obviously going to comment on what our plans are or anything. All I can say is that there are a number of issues which we've been diligently researching. We've received memos from the staff. And it's, you know, we're going to give it every full consideration.
When are you researching it? You're here in the room all day.
No, we have a number of people working on it. I've done some work on it. In fact, I'm on my way now to the library to do some research myself.
Is time of the essence? Do you feel under any pressure to get this thing in the court quickly?
Well, we're going to do it as quickly as possible, given giving full consideration to the difficult legal issues involved.
Well, what does that mean, though? What date?
I'm not going to predict. I think Mr. Dash said that he expected us to file sometime next week, and I think we will meet that deadline.
I heard something about a staff of 15 lawyers. Is that right?
Well, our entire legal staff, I don't think numbers that number of lawyers we have on the staff. Obviously, most of them are involved in working on preparing the elaborate work necessary for the hearings, but we are putting in a fair amount of time late into the night on the legal issues.
Have you called in any outside experts or consultants on this?
We haven't yet. That'll be a decision made by the committee. I'd rather not comment on the extent to which we will need outside help or additional help. So far, the thing is under control, in my opinion, and we're pursuing the various alternatives.
Why are we having this delay now, do you know?
No, I don't. I just came from a meeting on the legal issues, and I'm going to do some follow-up research myself on the question.
That isn't the same meeting that's going on in Senator
No. This was a meeting among people working on the legal questions.
Well, since you attended that meeting, you'd be in a position now to tell us what legal theory the committee's going to follow in that suit.
Well, I might be in a position, but I am not about to do it. In fact, I'm not really in a position. I think this is going to require a lot more in the way of discussion, research. Obviously, we've been working very diligently on it, and we'll make up our minds when we have all the information we feel we need.
Have you called in the computer the committee is using? Is that helping you at all in this other matter?
Well, not in connection with the legal work. It does help us in connection with the hearings, where we have a considerable amount of information on the computer, and we can obtain information about particular witnesses who come up and utilize the computer in that way.
What does the delay mean in getting these tapes? When I say that, I'm suggesting that perhaps ultimately you may get them if your suit is successful. What does the delay mean? You've got Mr. Ehrlichman, for example, testifying now. Some of those tapes perhaps concern conversations that Mr. Ehrlichman had with the president, but you don't have them now. So what happens ultimately? If you ever get the tapes, you bring Mr. Ehrlichman back?
Well, that'll have to be decided by the committee. Obviously, if we had the tapes, many of the issues now in doubt could be resolved. Meanwhile, we're doing the best we can on the basis of the information that we have, including the material that we've researched, the public statements of the witnesses, our interviews, and whatever help we can get from any sources.
Dave, we understand the hearings may be extended another week and maybe all the way through August. The staff work is really backed up now, hasn't it, in terms of this other litigation and the backlog of witnesses and so forth?
Well, I think we have the situation well in hand. It is an awful lot of work. People are working 7 days a week into the night. I think that we are prepared. I think we're doing, if I may say so, a good job. There's just a lot to be done, and we will get it done.
Thank you very much. David M. Dorson, the assistant counsel to the Watergate Committee. Doug?
Thank you, Carl. We've just learned that the reason for the delay is a meeting in Senator Ervin's office between Senator Ervin, Howard Baker, Majority Counsel Sam Dash, and Minority Counsel Fred Thompson. We understand that that meeting is now over, and that in fact any minute Senator Ervin is due and Senator Baker is due back in the committee room. Might just take a moment to talk about the atmosphere here, especially on a Friday afternoon. There has grown up, after 8 weeks, a sort of a caucus room family, if you want to call it that. The members of the committee itself, various reporters. Now we see Senator Ervin hurrying in. And everybody is pretty tired on a Friday afternoon. The council members, the reporters, if you'll notice, everybody's shoulders sort of start going down on those desks along about 3:30, 4 o'clock. People are listening hard, trying to keep up with facts, with dozens and dozens of characters and thousands of facts. And after 5 days of it, everybody in this room, you may be sure, is ready for the weekend. If anybody is withstanding it at all and looks fresher than anybody else, it's that 76-year-old white-haired man you see sitting down there right now. And so with the gavel, we'll hear the afternoon's proceedings.
The committee will come to order, and Senator Montoya will examine the witness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ehrlichman, you have testified that during the period from June 17th or shortly thereafter up until the time you resigned your position at the White House that you intermittently kept up with the course of the investigation that was going on in-house, out-of-house, and otherwise?
Yes, sir.
And that shortly after June 17th, according to testimonies presented here by Mr. Strawn, and I believe confirmed by you, you were assigned to be in charge of the investigation shortly after it occurred.
That's not correct, Senator.
All right, give me your version of it.
Well, I think what Mr. Strawn testified to was that in a conversation with Mr. Higby, who apparently was in Florida with the president on that weekend, Mr. Higby said that I knew about it or was in charge of it or some such thing. The fact is that on that weekend of the Watergate break-in, I apparently was one of the few senior members of the White House staff who was here in the city. And the rest were either with the president in Florida or somewhere else. And so for the brief time on the Monday, before the president's party got back, and I think they got back late Monday, as I recall, I started the ball rolling. And
what did you do?
I called Mr. Dean, who had just returned from the Philippines, and he and I had a meeting on Monday noon, and from then on, as far as I was concerned, he had the ball.
Who threw the ball to him?
I did.
What instructions did you give him?
I told him that I thought that it was important for us to keep well informed of all of the fast-breaking events in this matter in order that our press office could be fully briefed and kept up with the developing events, because I, as I testified before, I saw this as a real campaign issue.
Did he report to you frequently on what he was uncovering?
I saw him a total of 9 times in the next 2 weeks, which is an unusually large number of times for my contacts with Mr. Dean.
And what did you see him about during those 9 times?
Well, among other things,
I mean, with respect to Watergate.
Yes, sir. He told me a number of things, and I have tried to make a list of them here, and I'll give them to you. He told me about the general facts of the surveillance of the Democratic National Committee headquarters, the fact that the Howard Johnson Motel had been employed as a listening post, the fact that a hotel room in the Watergate Hotel had been found, which had some of the burglars' possessions in it, the fact that they used fictitious names and papers, and that they had large quantities of money and $100 bills. He told me about the fact that Hunt had a safe still at the White House, and then I've testified previously to the meeting which we held Monday afternoon to try and determine the facts with regard to Hunt's employment at the White House, and that was as a result of a report from Mr. Dean.
Well, did you feel, Mr. Ehrlichman, I don't want to go into all the detail, did you feel that Mr. Dean was telling you almost everything that he was uncovering on a day-by-day basis?
That was certainly my assumption, Senator, yes.
All right. And did this continue even after the first 2 weeks?
No, sir. Before very long, I left the city. I believe it was the 26th, I'll have to check that. Of course, the 24th and 25th I was away. The president went to Harrisburg to see the results of the Agnes flood, and so we were gone those 2 days. And then the 29th, I left for a trip to Springfield, Illinois, Lansing, Michigan, Northern California, and finally ended up at San Clemente.
I think we can save some time, Mr. Ehrlichman. I just want to go through with you over the communications that you had with Mr. Dean with respect to Watergate over the long span up until April the 15th of 1973.
All right, sir.
I mean, in a general way.
I have that in summary form, and perhaps I can give that to you rather quickly. In the month of June, I saw him 9 times, and 8 of those times related to Watergate. In the month of July, I saw him 3 times, and only 2 times related to Watergate. In the month of August, 4 times, of which no times related to Watergate. September, 3 times. I'm not able to tell you as to that. One of those meetings was with regard to the foreign grain sales, and I don't know what the other two were. October, I saw him twice. Once was a common cause lawsuit, and I don't know what the other one was. November, I saw him 4 times. One was with regard to the Watergate, 2 with regard to Segretti, which I guess you lump in to that general subject. December, 5 times, twice on the subject of Watergate. January, 7 times, of which Watergate could be considered to have been the subject of 3 of those meetings. February, 5 times, 3 of which, including La Costa, were on the subject of Watergate. March, 3 times, one of those times was with regard to the Hunt blackmail. Well, actually, 2 of those were, and the other one, the question of testimonial appearance.
Was that in March?
Yes, sir.
What about the January meeting? Didn't you testify about the January meeting with respect to Mr. Hunt?
Yes, and that's one of the 3, or that's actually 2 of the 3 that I that I mentioned.
All right.
And April, 3 times, and all of those were Watergate matters.
So, in effect, you met quite a few times with Mr. Dean about Watergate.
Yes, sir.
And would you say that during those times which you met with him, that you discussed fully all aspects of Watergate, White House possible involvement, and also possible involvement of personnel at the CRP?
Well, as it turned out, not. I thought so at the time, but I now know that that wasn't the case.
Well, were you engaging in speculation with Mr. Dean as to who might be involved as a result of these conversations?
On occasion, we did.
And quite a few figures or names were discussed during your conversations, is that not correct?
You mean a great number of people?
Yes.
No, I wouldn't say that, Senator.
Well, then, as a result of all this information and what you independently collected, you used this as a basis for briefing Mr. Ziegler, preliminary to any press conferences that you might have had, that he might have had?
Not inevitably, no. There would be times, for instance, when I was not with Mr. Ziegler. I had an independent travel schedule, and very often Mr. Ziegler would have briefings and I wouldn't be available, or he would be out of town with the president and I would be here in Washington.
Well,
but we tried as nearly as possible to talk over particularly technical matters. For instance, when the civil depositions were being taken, Mr. Ziegler and I recall, had a conversation about a civil deposition, what the rules of evidence were, why hearsay could come into a civil deposition where it couldn't come into a trial.
Well, the point I want to make, Mr. Ehrlichman, that you have testified here that on numerous occasions you did brief Mr. Ziegler preliminary to any press conferences that he might have.
Well, I don't think I said it quite that way, Senator.
Well, how did you
say
it?
What I attempted to impart was that on more or less a daily basis, Mr. Ziegler and I would try and touch base about any current issues that needed my assistance, and not in every case would he need my assistance for some of these things. But where we had, for instance, the issue of the Clean Water Bill and the President's possible veto of that bill, where we had the spending limit that was a hot issue in the Congress. Mr. Ziegler and I would sit down and we would talk through what the central issues were, why the President took the position he did, what the other view was, to try and give him a working knowledge of the subject matter. And we tried to do that with various aspects of this case as it went along.
But did you ever brief him on Watergate, on the part or concern of the White House and so forth?
Well, I don't know quite what you mean by brief.
Or did you provide any input
into
the background which went into those press conferences?
I'm sure that I did at times.
All right. Now, there were quite a few pronouncements by the White House, by the President, with respect to the Watergate affair. And I'm going to relate those in sequence. On August the 29th, 1972, the President, in response to a question, stated, and this is part of his answer, "In addition to that, within our own staff, under my direction, counsel to the President, Mr. Dean, has conducted a complete investigation of all leads which might involve any present members of the White House staff or anybody in the government. I can say categorically that his investigation indicates that no one in the White House staff, no one in this administration presently employed, was involved in this bizarre, very bizarre incident." Then on a subsequent date, the President, in his October 5th, 1972 conference, stated in response to a reporter's question as follows: "Now, when we talk about a clean breast, let's look at what's happened. The FBI assigned 133 agents to this investigation. It followed out 1,800 leads. It conducted 1,500 interviews." Then, subsequently, during the press conference of April 17, 1973, the President stated as follows: "On March 21st, as a result of serious charges which came to my attention, some of which were publicly reported, I began intensive new inquiries into this whole matter. Last Sunday afternoon, the Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General Peterson, and I met at length in the EOB to review the facts which had come to me in my investigation and also to review the progress of the Department of Justice investigation." Then he stated, "As a result, on March the 21st, I personally assumed the responsibility for coordinating intensive new inquiries into the matter, and I personally ordered those conducting the investigation to get all the facts and to report them directly to me right here in this office." That was prior to the time that he assigned responsibility to you to conduct a further inquiry, which was on March 30th, 1973. Is that correct?
Well, I thought that press conference that you said was April 17. Is that not correct? That would have been...
Yes, but I'm referring to the date of March the 21st,
which
you recited.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, up to that time, Mr. Dean had been talking to you. Other people in the White House had been talking to you. And there had been quite a few articles in the Washington Post by Mr. Woodward and Mr. Bernstein. And in fact, most of the information about which you were inquiring with all these FBI people had already appeared in the Washington Post. Now, did you read the Washington Post on or about that time?
What time, Senator?
During the course of your different conferences with Mr. Dean, during the course of your different inquiries, were you reading the Washington Post about the what was being uncovered through Woodard and Mr. Bernstein?
Well, I wouldn't certainly want to leave the impression that the White House relied on the Washington Post for reliable information very much of the time. The fact is that our news summary contained digests of what a great number of newspapers were printing, both about the Watergate and other matters.
Well, but as a matter of fact, they were uncovering more than all these FBI people were.
No, sir.
At least there's been no information coming to us that was more accurate than what these reporters were uncovering at the time.
Then I think you're in trouble, Senator.
Well, I think the whole country is in trouble.
I submit to you, sir, that the FBI reports, which we were receiving at that time, on the face of them and from everything we knew about it and from everything the Attorney General was telling us about it and everything that the prosecuting attorneys were telling us, could be relied upon.
All right, now let me ask you this question. You said that you conducted an inquiry pursuant to instructions from the President, instructions which you received on March the 30th. Now, who did you investigate? Who did you interview? And with what objective in mind were you conducting this inquiry?
I was, as I say, it was not really an investigation in the technical sense of the word. And I have declined to identify it as such at all times. But as I said before, the people whom I interviewed included Paul O'Brien, Herbert Kalmbach, John Dean, Gordon Strawn, Charles Colson, John Mitchell, Jeb Magruder. I had a telephone conversation with Mr. Gray, which may or may not be considered to be included in that. And Mr. Crow.
Did you interview Mr. LaRue?
No, sir.
Mr. Mardian?
No.
Mr. Kalmbach?
Yes.
Mr. Stans?
No.
Mr. Sloan?
No.
In fact, you turned him out of your office, so to speak.
No, I don't believe that's quite fair, Senator. What I did was, I think, what I should have done, which was to say to him, before you talk to somebody in my situation, go and talk to a lawyer. And since you're the treasurer and you tell me you've got the legal liability for all this and you haven't talked to a lawyer, Duke, go talk to a lawyer first.
All right. Would you say that you conducted very intensive interviews with these people?
As I say, Senator, I can't claim this to be an exhaustive investigation. I conducted, I think, reasonably thorough interviews. They lasted between an hour and 2 hours, most of them.
Were they conducted in your office?
Sir?
Were they conducted in your office?
Not in every case. My principal concern was to try and get a feel for whether anybody in the White House was involved in this. I felt that's the place I had to begin. So most of my questions were not directed to what people like Mr. Mardian or Mr. LaRue did at the committee. Occasionally people told me those things. But my principal focus was to say, what do you know about people in the White House? Do you know about anybody else in the White House who might be involved? Or if they were talking about an individual in the White House, I would say, well, what else do you know about him that might in any way involve him in this? And that was my principal focus. But the other part of my job, other than just interviewing these few people, was to try and get on top of these very complex law questions which Mr. Dean had been working with and which I had not. And it took a great deal of my time, and I might say, this was the one of the President's principal focuses in this time, was this dilemma of separation of powers, executive privilege, attorney-client privilege, the whole legal underpinning for this process.
If you will pardon me, Mr. Ehrlichman, you testified about that this morning, and I don't want to appear repetitious in my questioning, and I don't want you to appear repetitious in your answers. Now, I'm merely interested in trying to ascertain from you what type of an inquiry.
Yes, sir.
Now, during the interviews which you had in your office, did you, on occasion, tape the conversations with these people?
On two occasions.
Which were those occasions?
Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Magruder.
Where are those tapes?
In the possession of your staff.
All right. Now, did you transcribe any interviews? Or arrange for their transcription?
In the sense of sitting down and dictating a summary or anything of that kind?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
And who has those interviews?
Well, I think what I did was to turn over my handwritten notes to the committee staff. There is one such transcription of my interview with Mr. Kalmbach, which I don't think that I have given to the committee staff. I'm not sure.
Are you prepared to give it to us?
Oh, yes, certainly.
Would you do that?
It may be that they have it. That question came up this morning, and I don't think we decided for sure.
We have a phone call.
No. This is a narrative that I dictated after my interview with Mr. Kalmbach.
Mr. Dash, did I not give you, I think I gave the U.S. Attorney's Office, less than a one-page memo of a meeting with between Mr. Ehrlichman and Mr. Kalmbach on April 6, 1973.
No. Mr. Wilson, I have no recollection,
well,
but I'm
quiet right now.
I'm very sure not. You may have given it to the prosecutor's office. You may have given it to the prosecutor's office, but not to this committee.
I always meant to give you the same thing. Perhaps I didn't do it.
I know you tried, but if you have it, we'd like to have it.
Sure. It's in one of your, it's wrapped up in one of your...
Now, who else did you take notes on?
Just those that I mentioned this morning, Senator. Do you want me to go through that list again?
No, I don't. I merely want you to tell this committee what did you ascertain as a result of these interviews with respect to each of the individuals? Did they convey to you any indication that they might have been involved in the Watergate affair prior to June 17th or in the cover-up after June 17th?
Yes, sir, they did.
All right, will you name those names?
Yes, sir. I wonder if I could refer to my notes in order to do that accurately.
Certainly may.
The last one had those. Well, then it's in there, this paper you're looking for. What do you got? You got Manila? Manila?
No, I'm right. I've got a couple of them. This morning, described fully the contents of my interview with Mr. O'Brien, I believe, and also my interview with Mr. Dean. The one which remains, which is responsive to your question, I think, is my interview with Mr. Magruder on April 14th at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. His attorneys, Mr. Sharp and Mr. Bierbauer, were with him at the time of the interview, and they had just come from an interview with the United States Attorney. The interview took about, I would guess, an hour and a half. And if you like, Senator, I can just take you quickly through the narrative of what Mr. Magruder told me, or I can pick things out if you're interested in something particular.
Now, just give me your conclusions from that interview.
Conclusions from the interview were that Mr. Magruder, and according to him, Mr. Mitchell,
and Mr. LaRue participated in an express and specific approval of the plan to break into and bug the Democratic National Committee headquarters. That this was an agreement or an approval which occurred in Key Biscayne at a meeting attended by the three of them, and that in addition to that particular project, McGovern headquarters and the Fontainebleau Hotel headquarters of the Democratic Convention were likewise to be bugged.
What date was this again?
This was an interview which I held on April 14, 1973.
All right. Proceed.
That, of course, and here you understand that this is what Mr. Magruder is saying to me. I can't vouch for the truth of this, but it's what he reported to me. That the proposal, which was approved at that time, had its genesis in a $1 million proposal which Mr. Dean and Mr. Liddy prepared. I asked him specifically about Mr. Dean because, as I said, I was focusing on White House people, and his description of Mr. Dean's participation in that planning was quite active. Mr. Liddy told Mr. Magruder, he said, that Mr. Dean had authorized the $1 million figure as the beginning budget level.
Did you, from your knowledge of the White House and the assignment of Mr. Dean, reach a determination that Mr. Dean had that kind of authority?
Oh, no. No, indeed.
You didn't believe that, did you?
What Mr. Magruder was telling me?
Yes.
I didn't know what to believe at this time, Senator. I was getting so many different hearsay stories from so many different people. I wasn't trying to evaluate what to believe and what not to believe.
All right, proceed.
He said that he took me through the four meetings in early 1972.
Well, I believe you testified to that, and I don't want
yes,
to delve into
repetition. Well, except that this is out of Magruder's mouth. And then he said that at some point in time, he informed Mr. Strawn, who was his primary contact at the White House, that they had an intelligence capability. He said, I got no problems from Mr. Strawn, and so I read that as an okay from higher up. I asked him whether he had any knowledge of whether anyone higher than Mr. Strawn in the White House had in fact approved this. He said he had no knowledge of any higher ups having done so. And the only people in the White House that he focused on as having had any connection whatsoever with this were Mr. Colson, Mr. Strawn, Mr. Dean, and Mr. Howard.
And may I interject here? What particular authority did Mr. Strawn have vis-a-vis the White House?
Mr. Strawn was about a fourth-level White House staffer with almost no authority of his own.
Well, what particular assignment did he have during the campaign? I understood that he was going from Mr. Haldeman's office to the CRP and back and forth. Now, did you know of this assignment?
No, sir.
Have you since found out about this assignment?
In the course of these hearings, I've learned a great deal more than I ever learned when I was in the White House.
You mean you didn't find out while you were at the White House about Mr. Strawn's assignment?
I knew almost nothing about the scope of Mr. Strawn's assignment while I was at the White House until late in the March-April period when I got into it and I began interviewing people, and he was one of the people I interviewed.
Well, what did you find out about him then?
At that time?
Yes.
Oh, that he was the liaison man between Mr. Haldeman and the committee to reelect for the purpose of keeping both ends of his liaison informed of the acts and desires of the other.
Did you know him?
Yes, sir.
Did you know him to be a very reliable young man?
Well, I didn't know him well enough to form an opinion as to his reliability.
Now, if he conveyed anything to the CRP or brought anything to Mr. Haldeman from the CRP, would you say that he was carrying out his assignment properly?
Oh, o'clock. I couldn't speculate as to that, sir.
Why can't you?
I just don't have that kind of knowledge. Now, as far as reliability is concerned, something occurs to me that perhaps you ought to know. My first interview with Mr. Strawn was on the occasion of his having just returned from the grand jury. And he came in rather shaken and told me that he didn't know what to do. And he was looking for somebody to give him some advice. He said that he had just come back from testifying to the grand jury that he had delivered $350,000 to Mr. LaRue. And he said, as soon as I left there, I knew that was wrong. I hadn't delivered $350,000 to Mr. LaRue. I had delivered some lesser sum because I remember that they took some money out, or I took some money out. I forgot how he put it. But some money had been taken out for advertising. Now, what should I do? And I said, well, do you have an attorney? He said, no, I don't. And I said, well, that's the first thing I think you ought to do is get some advice. The second thing it seems to me that you ought to do, subject to your attorney's advice, is to go and tell the prosecutor you think you've made a mistake in your testimony.
All right.
But that is probably the only real gauge I have of Mr. Strawn's testimonial reliability.
Then what did you find out about, what conclusion did you reach with respect to Mr. Strawn as a result of the interviews that you had?
That what he told me in the second interview that I had with him, I felt was correct and the truth, and that he was trying very hard to tell me everything he knew. I had a favorable impression of what he told me. That is, of his attempt to tell the truth.
Well, the point I'm trying to make, did you reach any conclusion from the interviews with respect to him as to whether or not he was involved either in the pre-June 17th complicity or after?
He told me that he had received from the Committee to Re-Elect notice that they had an intelligence capability. And I confronted him with what Mr. Magruder had alleged, which was that Mr. Magruder had sent over to him a budget, which had included specific reference to bugging. And he said, no, he would have remembered if anything like that had come over. He was sure that he had never seen anything like that. He said that he did receive from Mr. Magruder some material designated sedan chair. And it looked to him like synopses of wiretap information. Of course, we've learned since that sedan chair was not a wiretap, but that was the only thing he said he received. He said he got no gemstone material at all.
Well, Mr. Ehrlichman, I'm just interested in what you concluded as of the interviews with respect to these individuals.
My conclusion with regard to Mr. Strawn was that he was a messenger, that he was not an active planner or executor of any plan, but simply a conveyor back and forth.
All right. Now, what conclusion did you reach with respect to Mr. Kalmbach?
My conclusion after talking with Mr. Kalmbach, as you will see in this memorandum that we have now given the staff, I take it, perhaps it is best if I simply read you a short portion of that as my then contemporaneous conclusion. That would probably be the best evidence. Do you have that, counsel?
I gave the only copy I had.
Do you want to just read it?
I'm running out of time now.
Very shortly, Senator.
I merely wanted to get an indication as to what kind of an inquiry you had conducted with respect to each individual.
All right, my inquiry with him was as to his money-raising efforts and whether or not he knew, either directly or whether he knew circumstances surrounding his efforts, which might have put him on notice that he was engaged in an effort to buy the silence of defendants, and I was satisfied that he did not know.
All right, inquiry did you make about Mr. Kalmbach?
I interviewed Mr. Kalmbach.
Just briefly, what inquiry did you interviewed him?
Yes, sir.
All right, and you taped his conversation?
No, sir. I made this memorandum afterward, which I've given to the staff.
All right.
And in that, I think you will see that it's my conclusion that he acted in the best of faith thinking that he was simply engaged in raising money for the defense fund purposes that he's testified to.
All right, then, how many interviews did you conduct as a result of your being commissioned by the president to go into this?
Well, let me refer to my list again. Ten. Yes, sir.
How long did it take you to conduct these interviews?
Well, I did this in the period between the 5th of April and the 14th of April.
All right. Now, the president indicated that he had also assigned...
Senator, the 15th of April. I beg your pardon. Because I saw Mr. Strawn at 9 o'clock Sunday morning the 15th.
All right. Now, what was this statement of the president all about when he stated that on March the 21st, as a result of serious charges which came to my attention, some of which were publicly reported, I began intensive new inquiries into this whole matter? Now, what did he mean by that?
Well, I think what he meant by that was the series of events starting March 21st and culminating April 17th, which would have been his conversation with Mr. Dean on the 21st, the McCord letter to Judge Sirica on, what, the 23rd or whatever it was, his sending Mr. Dean to Camp David to write out his statement, Mr. Dean's return without the statement, his turning the investigation over, taking it from Mr. Dean, his turning the inquiry over to me, my efforts to talk to witnesses through this time, the parallel efforts, and I don't mean to in any way diminish the efforts of the investigators in the Department of Justice and in the prosecutor's office who are doing an extraordinarily effective job right at this time. You see, when I talked to Mr. Magruder, for instance, he had already been to see the U.S. attorney and told him everything as a result of their efforts. So these were all parallel efforts going on, and there was a lot of reporting. The president had his meeting with the attorney general and Mr. Peterson on that Sunday, and they compared notes as to all of these investigations, and then this all came to a head on that following Tuesday.
And then would you say that up until March, you were convinced and the president was convinced at the White House that there was no White House involvement?
Yes, sir.